Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Today's guest begins her book with a profound quote. It goes like this. At the start of every disaster movie, there's a scientist being ignored. It's true, right? You've seen disaster movies. Well, Dr. Samantha Montano spent years in New Orleans working with various nonprofits on recovery efforts related to both Katrina and the BP oil disaster in 2010. Her new book, Disasterology, is part memoir, part expert analysis. It is extremely well-researched and extremely well-written. It's a passionate, a personal account of country in crisis, one unprepared to deal with the disasters of today, let alone those looming in our future. Dr. Samantha Montano has a BS in psychology, an MS and PhD in emergency management, and is currently an assistant professor of emergency management at Massachusetts Maritime Academy. She's been interviewed in the New York Times, The Atlantic, National Geographic. The list is long. And the name of her new book is Disasterology, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Climate Crisis. And here's my guest, Dr. Samantha Montano. Dr. Samantha Montano, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. I love your book, and we've got so much to talk about today. But before we dive into it, I just wanted to mention this. I spoke with scientist Dr. Kate Bieberdorf a couple of weeks ago. She's a chemist and a science entertainer, and she's striving to make science engaging and really fun. And I saw on your Twitter handle that you said, I'm not a regular disasterologist. I am a cool disasterologist. So let's begin with what you mean by disasterologist.
Sure, yeah. So disasterologist is a word that I use to describe anybody who does disaster research. So there are, you know, all different researchers working in different disciplines, history, psychology, sociology, that are studying disasters. I myself work within the discipline of emergency management, and so that term is just kind of an umbrella term to describe the work that we're doing.
Right. Well, it's great that we have women leading the way in this, and you know, certainly great to talk with Kate Bieberdorf. It's good to talk with you today about your new book, Disasterology, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Climate Crisis. And I guess let's begin with a snapshot of what led you to writing this book. You had a turning point when you went to New Orleans, right?
Yeah, when I was in high school, Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure happened in New Orleans. And I had the opportunity to go to the city to volunteer. And I had grown up on the East Coast. We had never had a disaster of that size. And so I didn't know what to expect. And when I got there, I saw just how much work needed to be done to rebuild essentially the entire city. And I also saw that although there were tons of people there volunteering and New Orleanians themselves were working hard to achieve that recovery, there still wasn't enough help coming in. And so I ended up moving to New Orleans, living there for several years, working on the recovery with different nonprofits.
Hmm. You say, and I think this is true, that most people see disasters, these kind of disasters, as freak events, as natural occurrences. You know, we think of hurricanes and tornadoes as inevitable. You say that's simply not true. Disasters are avoidable. So talk to us a little about that.
Yeah, when we talk about what exactly a disaster is, sometimes people equate that with what is actually just a hazard. So not every time a hurricane forms does that cause a disaster? If a hurricane forms and it just goes out into the Atlantic and doesn't come ashore, it doesn't bother anybody, that isn't a disaster. It's when that hurricane interacts with us, when it comes ashore, it interacts with a community that doesn't have strong building codes, that has not updated or maintained their infrastructure to withstand those kinds of impacts, when the people who live there don't have enough money to evacuate for that storm. That is where you start to see a disaster actually happen. And so if we think about what it is that could be done to prevent that disaster from happening, the things that we can change are all within our control, right?
Right.
We won't necessarily stop that hurricane, but we can build differently. We can build in different places. We can make sure people have the resources that they need to leave when they need to.
Exactly. Communication strategies are really key. And I, reading your book, realized just how many events that we've had over the years where the communications strategies have really let us down. And that hurts me because I work in communications. But what's the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe?
Yeah, so when we're thinking about kind of all of these bad events that happen, we have a tendency kind of just in media or colloquially to say, oh, that's a disaster. But there are actually different kind of categories of these events that occur. So on our low end, we have emergencies. These are happening in your community every day, you know, car accidents on the highway, an apartment building that burns down. Those are things that are handled locally by your local first responders using local resources. Then we have disasters. These are bigger events. They are more complex to manage. They involve people coming in from outside of your community to help. You need the support of the federal government usually to come in and help.
Right.
So that's your Joplin tornadoes, your Superstorm Sandys. And then on the higher end, we have catastrophes. These are events that don't just overwhelm the local community, but where surrounding communities, even, you know, federal government becomes overwhelmed or isn't responding in the way that they need to. And these are kind of on the more rare side. In the U.S., we're talking about Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Maria. Certainly COVID would fit into this catastrophe category.
Right. So our language is very key in how we respond and in fact, how we set up our strategies too. You say this book, Disasterology, is for everyone, and I agree. I want to put that out there now, Samantha, because for a number of reasons. Firstly, you know, this is a great book. It's really fun to read. It just pulled me through. Some of the stories are not so fun, but, you know, it pulled me through, and I just wanted to keep reading more. Secondly, these events affect all of us one way or another. And thirdly, because realistically, I think a lot of people are put off when they hear the term climate crisis. They're kind of roll their eyes and say they're tired of hearing about it, or, you know, what can I do about it at this point? And also because a lot of people just don't get science, and you really help put this on a level playing field. So share with us, please, why people should care and why you say this book is for everyone.
Yeah, you know, when I first got started doing disaster work, I was 18 years old. I had no background in disaster.
Right.
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was looking at. And I didn't really have any resources to turn to. There were, you know, textbooks. There were a handful of books that kind of came out around that time that kind of were talking about disasters in some ways, but it wasn't providing any kind of like overarching way of thinking about this. And it was kind of by accident that I stumbled into emergency management, stumbled into this opportunity to study disasters. And that's something I hear a lot from my current students, from people who I meet after I give talks, that that are interested in disasters. Maybe they've experienced one, or they're watching all of these disasters unfold around us, but they don't really know where to start, and they don't know how to really get a handle on this overarching, like, this massive field of emergency management that's operating all around us all the time and affecting us all the time.
Right.
And so when I was writing it, I, you know, did the thing that authors do where I wrote the book that I wish that I had been able to read when I was 18, just starting out in this field. So, you know, I think it's really important as these disasters are increasing around the country, more people are beginning to understand that climate change isn't something that we can just ignore, that it's here and it's affecting us directly, that books like this are really important for people to be able to kind of jump in and start to learn about this so that they can participate in the activism, participate in their own communities.
Yes, and it's described as part memoir, part expert analysis. And that's what makes it so relatable, is that you included your journey through writing this book. You say you wrote all over the place, in many, many places around the country, many coffee shops, on lakes, anywhere. And I love this, that you said each of these places gave me a future to fight for.
Yeah, you know, when I think about climate change, you know, it can feel very abstract. I'm the first to admit that. But when you start thinking about the place that you grew up, or the cities you like to visit, or the place where you went to school, all of those places are going to be, if they are not already, affected by climate change. And I think it's useful to think about how those places will or are being impacted. So, you know, as motivation to act, to not, you know, just sit idly by.
Right, right. I want to look at a couple of the things that we've been facing more and more the last few years. I used to live in Southern California. We had wildfires, never anything like we are seeing now. So talk to us a little bit about this, because former President Donald Trump blamed poor forest management for the wildfires, which we've been seeing. You say that's not only factually inaccurate, it signals a much larger problem that should be of concern to all of us who want to prevent further disasters like this.
Yeah, you know, there is oftentimes, you know, we hear these conversations about climate denialism, right, where people are denying that the climate is changing, or they're denying why the climate is changing. We also have this kind of thread running through these narratives of these events of disaster denialism. Certainly, we have seen that with COVID play out in a very dramatic way. But even in how folks are talking about wildfires, talking about some of these other disasters that have occurred, you know, there is a lack of being truthful, or a lack of willingness to understand why these disasters are occurring, right? It is not only climate change. The solution is to not go rake the forest. There are people who study what it is that we need to be doing to mitigate this risk, to keep our communities safe. And unfortunately, many politicians ignore those experts, those researchers, those communities where that expertise is held. And it is a form of denialism about what is happening. When you are, you know, taking up airtime, you know, rewriting this narrative of why a disaster has happened, you are creating barriers or preventing us from being able to make those changes that are needed to actually prevent those disasters from continuing in the future.
Yes, I think one of the things that's so upsetting is not just misinformation and people misreporting, but it's disinformation. You know, when people strategize to deliberately put out information that's misleading and absolutely untrue, I mean, I think that's very upsetting. So one of the things that you talk about in the book is media, and the media is not to blame for all of this misinformation and disinformation that's coming out. I mean, there are people who, you know, hire very huge public relations firms to spread this misinformation and disinformation. What did you learn from the oil spill and BP? I remember reading in the book that you kind of had an eye-opening experience when that happened and you saw all of the information coming out about that.
Yeah, while I was living in New Orleans doing Katrina recovery work, the BP oil disaster happened in the Gulf. And I had been working with a couple environmental groups in the city, and we started to help out as we could along the coast in communities like Grand Isle that were on the front lines of experiencing the impact from the oil spill. And that was the first time that I had really seen one of these massive responses unfold. I had gotten to New Orleans once. We were already in the recovery, and response and recovery are two totally different beasts. And so as the response was unfolding over several months, I saw the number of agencies, the number of organizations, just thousands and thousands of people descend on the Louisiana coast. And I saw the challenges of coordinating all those people, communicating across all those people. And I also saw the role that media was playing in how the reporting was unfolding. I was there on the ground locally watching what was happening. And when I'd go home at night and turn on CNN, those stories did not, you know, that reality of what was happening did not always align. Mm. So I was fortunate to be able to do some work with some of those journalists that were coming in to connect them with local folks that were directly experiencing the impact of the oil and chemicals and the entire event to try and get kind of those more local, accurate stories told. And it certainly opened my eyes to how complicated it is, honestly, to tell the story of disaster as it's happening. There are so many moving parts, particularly in a situation like the BP oil disaster, where you have corporations intentionally hiding information or putting out that misinformation. It's an incredibly complex situation to navigate.
It is, you know, and I found when the riots were happening out here, the protests and they got violent out here in the Northwest, mainly down in Portland, I was following a couple of on-the-ground journalists and young guys with a video camera who were out there in the field, you know, filming as it was happening, posting on Twitter, almost live as it was happening. And it took days for any of that to make mainstream media, and I kept pinging all the leading news anchors, why aren't you covering this? Why aren't you covering this? And it's very frustrating because I can imagine that, you know, in something like Hurricane Katrina, when, you know, that's not being covered accurately, it does not help anybody. It serves no one. And so it sounds as though, you know, media at large needs to do a better job of assigning somebody to specialize in this.
Yeah, exactly. There are really only a handful of journalists across the country that are kind of what I would call dedicated disaster journalists. They're really fantastic at what they do, and they really have, had that depth of expertise that they've learned in that area. But unfortunately, what we see a lot of media outlets do is just, hand the disaster off to who's ever covering breaking news when it happens.
Yeah.
And that person doesn't necessarily understand how to cover disasters. They don't understand what they're looking at. And it's frustrating. You need somebody there who understands how FEMA works, who understands what emergency management agencies should be doing so that you can know if they are not doing that. And so you can be that accountability, you can investigate where things are going wrong. All of that requires having a depth of expertise and experience in covering these kinds of events. So, you know, hopefully moving forward, that it is an area that receives more investment from media.
Absolutely. It is important. We rely on good journalism to hold corporations, our governments, communities responsible. And I let's go into FEMA while we're talking about that, because we kind of assume that all government agencies have some kind of oversight committee or accountability ladder. I know from 17 years of radio, that is simply not true. And there's nothing on FEMA, right? There's no oversight committee at all. Has that changed?
So there are many committees that do provide some oversight for FEMA, but there is no... there tends to be very little coordination or communication between those committees, and so there's nothing comprehensive. And so what we see in terms of congressional oversight is that it's incredibly minimal. It is really only when a senator or representative gets an earful from one of their local constituents that they're, you know, holding a hearing. And even when they hold those hearings, they don't tend to know what questions to ask. There is a lack of understanding among members of Congress, even about what FEMA does, what FEMA should be doing. Mm-hmm. And certainly none of them are looking at FEMA in a comprehensive way, which is really what is needed. So when we do see that Congress makes changes or funds something within FEMA, they tend to be these kind of one-off projects or these kind of one-off changes that may fix one kind of small problem within FEMA, but it's nothing that gets at these much bigger kind of comprehensive problems within FEMA.
Right. And it seemed that going back to Hurricane Maria, it was 2017, right, in Puerto Rico?
Mm-hmm.
It seems that that became so politicized, they didn't get anywhere near the help they needed, and it's still very much a mess over there. What can we do? I mean, what can citizens do about, making an impact there? Because there was definitely outrage about it.
Yeah, a lot of things. So first of all, to your point that Puerto Rico is very much still in the recovery process from Hurricane Maria, there are, a number of organizations, nonprofits that are in Puerto Rico working on recovery efforts that are local to Puerto Rico that you can kind of Google and find and support financially if you're able to. Looking at kind of the bigger picture here of what we need to be doing, when we donate after a disaster, that's good, that helps that community, but it doesn't do anything to be proactive for the next disaster and to try and prevent that next disaster from happening.
Right.
So I think it's really important that we look at how we can be affecting change politically. I always say the most important thing you can do for emergency management is vote for candidates that understand climate change is happening, that have an awareness of these disasters and at least seem to want to do something about these disasters, whether that's, national candidates or locally. But also to, call your Senate. You can call your senators when a disaster happens somewhere else in the country. Talk to them about the need for changes to emergency management. Get this on their radar. It kind of very surprisingly is not on a lot of members of Congress's radar.
Right.
This is a huge problem as we move forward. That, this problem is not going away. It is getting worse by the day. So any kind of organizing and advocacy that you can do to any of your representatives is hugely helpful.
Yes, I mean, ultimately, politicians are supposed to work for us. And so our vote is very, very, very important. I want to talk about recovery. You said earlier response and recovery are two different beasts. And a few years back, I interviewed an author who lost absolutely everything in a disaster. I believe it was Hurricane Sandy, but I could be wrong about that. But she lost everything. Her whole family did. 12 months later, she was struggling to put things back together. And she told me she had never felt so alone, so desperate, so vulnerable, so incapable. And it was a shock to her. She'd been a very successful businesswoman. And suddenly she felt just desperate and incompetent and, you know, still living in poor conditions, etc. So talk to us a little bit about recovery and what we need to know around that and how it can be improved.
Yeah, unfortunately, that I think is a very common experience. Disaster survivors very often call recovery the second disaster. Mm. They talk about, you know, I survived the first disaster, and then I had to go through this recovery process, and in some ways it was just as bad. For some, it feels almost even worse. There are a lot of different reasons for this, but the kind of big one is that there are not enough resources for people when they need to go through recovery. The way that our system is set up is such that people are expected to rely on their own resources, their savings accounts, insurance if they have it, and then they are expected to rely on kind of their social networks, their friends, their family to support them. And when that is not enough, which for many people it is not, most of us cannot rebuild our house from the ground up with what's in our savings account, they turn towards government. And contrary to this, you know, myth of FEMA showing up with some big check, they receive very little money from FEMA. At most, you can receive around $33,000. But for many, that average is much lower, around $5,000 or $7,000. And that really leaves people to turn towards nonprofits who do incredible work in recovery, but are overwhelmed with how many disasters are happening around the country. They don't necessarily have the resources they need to be meeting everybody's needs. And so you just kind of end up in limbo, going back and forth between these different sources, trying to piece things back together. You know, there are these bureaucratic barriers that you're trying to jump through, all while managing being displaced, managing the emotional fallout of that disaster. And so recovery itself, you know, like I said, it can feel like the second disaster.
Yeah. And it's something that I honestly had never thought of before, because you see the response teams going in and you see people helping, but then as they move out, that's when the real reality sets in and people are in trouble. You've obviously...
This is where the media factors in again, too. When we think about the media coverage of disasters, it is almost entirely covering the response to a disaster. Mm-hmm. They're showing those life-saving measures. They're showing that first 24, 48 hours, and then they tend to move on to the next thing. And that means that recovery isn't on your TV. If you do not have to go through recovery yourself, if you don't know somebody who's gone through recovery, then how would you know what that experience is like? There's you know, nearly a complete lack of coverage of those experiences that people are going through. When there is coverage of those recoveries, it tends to be from those local journalists who do a good job, but because they're local, it's not being connected to the stories of what's happening in other communities across the country. And because that's so siloed, it's difficult for people to really see how common this is and to see that this is, you know, not, you know, the failures that are happening in your community in terms of recovery is not a failure of the recovery system. That is the recovery system operating in the way that it was designed. The failure is in how we have designed our recovery system.
Right. And I know one of the things you write in the book is that you say since you were born, you were taught we're responsible for the protection of our own communities, and we can't rely on government to protect us, or politicians in particular. We can't rely on them to prioritize our well-being. So community building, which we have lost that art, is so important in these situations, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The research shows that the social capital that a community has, you know, how well you know your neighbors, how well your community works together, that is a huge factor in how you're able to move through that response and especially move through that recovery.
Yeah, and we're almost at the end of our conversation here, but I want to try and squeeze this in here. Was there anything during your book is meticulously researched? You've got 40 pages of notes at the end there. Was there anything that really shocked you during your research? I know one of the things you said in the book is that after you'd written it, you had to go back and rewrite a certain section because we are breaking disaster records so frequently that that information needed updating already.
Yeah, I did. I was working on this book for about 4 years or so, and so in the time that it took me to write it, many of the disasters that ended up in that book happened, and so I would have to go back and update the strongest hurricane or whatever it was as I went along. I had to throw out the entire last chapter of the book when COVID happened and rewrite that whole COVID section. So there was certainly a lot of kind of juggling and trying to keep up with these disasters, which, you know, are coming at us more and more quickly.
Well, Dr. Samantha Montano, job well done. I'm glad you stuck at it. And the book is called Disasterology, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Climate Crisis, and it truly is a good read. And I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, disaster-ology.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Do what you can in your community to work towards building that stronger community, making decisions that will keep your community safe in the future.
Dr. Samantha Montano, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.